This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 14th, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open meeting for the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, November 14th, 2013 will now come to order. I apologize for the delay. We had some late submitted documents and we needed to read them. We don't have any minutes today. So the first item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-13, Freshman Holdem.
Excuse me.
Et al. And I know we have some late submitted documents on this.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 13-46, 13-46-A, referred to as draft B, 13-46-B, referred to as draft C, 13-45-A, and 13-43-A. Thank you.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents 13-46A, 13-46B, 13-45A, and 13-43A. I think that's all of them. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. And that brings us to Freshman Holdem. Ms. Wallstriker.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1346, 1346A, and 1346B are alternative draft responses to advisory opinion request 2013-13. The requester asks whether it may use only the name Freshman Holdem and the URL of its website to identify itself in disclaimers on emails, web pages, and printed materials. Drafts A and C conclude that the requester may not use only the shortened name and its URL and disclaimers because that would not give readers adequate notice of the identity of the persons paying for the communication. Draft B concludes that the requester may identify itself by the shortened name Freshman Holdem and its URL in its disclaimers. We did not receive any comments on the request or on any of the drafts. And if the commission votes to approve any of the drafts, we ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wallstriker. And given the lateness of the drafts, I think technical and conforming edits might be a very good idea. Are there any questions for counsel or discussion on the draft? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that that we have an agreement amongst the commissioners. We've been going back and forth. We've been operating off of the draft C, which was released this morning. And I understand that we have agreement, provided that on page 6 of draft C, the paragraph beginning on line 5 and extending until line 15, that we would strike that. And with that change, I believe that not to jump the gun on anybody else, but I believe that we may have an agreement if everyone else finds that edit fine.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. And just for the edification of the public, since this draft did come around fairly late, it's draft C is actually an edit of draft A. Make sure I have the numbers right, and comes to the same conclusion with some wording changes, since some language that was taken out that I think some people would have preferred to see in, but sometimes it's easier to take things out in order to get an agreement. And I am prepared to support the draft as described by Commissioner Peterson. Is there any discussion? If not, I will ask for a motion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yes, Madam Chair. With respect to advisory opinion request 20-13, Freshman Holdem JFC, I move that the Commission adopt agenda document 13-46-B, referred to as draft C, with edits as explained by Commissioner Peterson, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any technical and conforming edits that may be necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Agenda Document 13-46B, which is Draft C of AO 2013-13, with the edits described by Commissioner Peterson, and authorize counsel to make technical and conforming edits. Is there any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Excellent. The next item on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2013-15. We have three draft responses. This is the Bitcoins AO. Let me just say at the outset that this raises, in some ways, a straightforward legal question. I mean, about whether a committee can accept something that appears to have value, at least to some people. And in other ways, it presents some very complicated and new and interesting factual riffs on that age-old question and the issues of how to value something like bitcoins and how to disclose the donors and make sure that we get adequate disclosure. So it has both easy aspects and hard aspects. And I think what we're going to do is have some discussion here. And Mr. Backer, I'm sure we're going to have questions for you on this, so why don't you join us at the table and get ready for that. But I'm not sure that we're going to actually be ready to vote on this today. I think that commissioners would like a little bit more time to contemplate this, but I think the discussion will be helpful hopefully we'll get some answers to some folks' questions. So with that, Ms. Selenkoff, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub, and good morning. Agenda documents 13-45 and 1345A present, as noted, three draft advisory opinions in response to the request from Conservative Action Fund. CAF is a non-connected committee that wishes to accept, as described, contributions in bitcoins. Bitcoin is a privately issued digital currency, and CAF asks 24 questions that you categorized in presenting this, generally in three categories. The first category of questions concerns whether CAF may accept bitcoins, and all three drafts conclude that CAF may accept bitcoins as in-kind contributions. The drafts diverge in their conclusions as to whether bitcoins are money, with the first draft, what I'll call draft A, concluding that they are not, and drafts B and C not resolving the question. The second category of questions concerns deposit valuation and reporting. All three drafts conclude that bitcoins should be deposited, valued, and reported generally like other in-kind contributions to be liquidated at a later date, and they provide guidance for doing so. Draft B attaches reporting examples. The third category of questions concerns disbursements of bitcoins. All three drafts conclude that CAF may not use bitcoins to make disbursements for goods and services. Instead, CAF must sell its bitcoins and deposit those funds in its campaign depository before using the funds for that purpose. Drafts A and B similarly conclude that CAF must sell its bitcoins and deposit those proceeds in a campaign depository before using those funds to make contributions to other committees. Draft C would conclude that CAF may contribute bitcoins to other committees. The Commission received two comments on the request and two comments from the same commenter on the various drafts. We would request the authority to make technical and conforming changes to a final document, which doesn't sound like it's going to be approved today, and I'm available to answer any questions you have.
But at some point, we will need those technical and conforming edits, Ms. Selenkoff, so thank you for the reminder. I will open it to the panel. Does anyone have any questions for either Ms. Selenkoff or Mr. Backer or comments? Commissioner Randall.
Council, in the first comment from Make Your Laws, on behalf of Make Your Laws PAC, their item 5, they talk about the difficulty of tracing and of knowing the original donor. And I wonder if you could give a little explanation of how the commission can be certain that any of these receipts, despite whatever it is that this organization would do to try to identify donors, that it may be difficult for them to do so, and how we can prevent the lack of disclosure that is inherent in this transaction.
Certainly.
Ms. Hanko.
The comment raises an issue that we actually address in a draft in a footnote, and that is the pseudonymous nature of bitcoins. Bitcoins as a currency are, some folks would say that they're not exactly anonymous, since on a computer level they are tracked by the Bitcoin community in order to validate Bitcoin purchases. And yet they're pseudonymous in the nature that persons in many online activities, including the use of bitcoins, might not use their actual names and identities in using that computer currency. The comment recognizes this and talks about it in some detail. In all three drafts, we note in footnotes of different numbers that CAF doesn't actually ask us to determine whether its method of identifying its contributors would suffice, and it doesn't ask us to address how CAF might address any divergence in actual identity versus Bitcoin associated identity. I do think that it's an issue. I don't think it's an issue that's necessarily unique to Bitcoin. For example, it's the commission issued a notice of a proposed rule to address technological issues earlier this year, where we raised the issue of prepaid credit cards and gift cards, which are used like credit cards now and might not, like bitcoins, have an actual identity as a verified by a banking institution associated with it. So I think that's an issue that the commission is struggling with. I don't have an exact answer as to how it must be addressed here, only because CAF did not ask and we did not delve into that. I think it's something the commission as a whole is considering in a rulemaking capacity as it moves forward.
Mr. Noti, do you want to add?
The footnote to which Ms. Selnikoff is referring, it's in draft A, it's footnote 8, which is on page 7. In draft B, it's footnote 6. And in draft C, it's footnote 7. I believe it's worded identically in all three drafts.
Well, we've been working on, I know staff has been working on drafting that rulemaking. Perhaps we should explicitly throw some questions about bitcoins into the mix there. Did you have further?
May I ask Mr.
Absolutely.
Backer a question too?
Commissioner Ravel.
To follow up on that question, Mr. Backer, you and there's certainly no aspersion with respect to the client that you represent, because you are representing that you would try to identify the donors and follow the campaign finance laws. But how can you live up to the commitment that you'd be able to do that? How can you assure that you would be able to identify the donors in these cases?
I think counsel identifies the problem very accurately, that if we did the exact same thing with Bitcoin contributors as we do with credit card contributors, we're still going to suffer the same problem, that we only have the ability to get the information that the donor is providing to us. And I think the commission regulations are actually drafted, not that we're required to obtain it, but that we're required to make our best efforts to obtain it. So we ask for the information once. If we don't get it, we follow up. I think to the extent that anybody is making a contribution, there are non-regulatory things that political action committees and candidates do. They follow up with their donors, because every donor is going to donate again, is our hope. It certainly is our hope. We would like donors to volunteer. And I think in that ongoing process of communicating with donors, you sometimes discover, well, there's something funny going on here. Without referencing the specific client, there was a time when I had a client where we discovered that somebody made a contribution was somebody who shouldn't have been able to make that contribution. We discovered it by just doing the normal, ordinary course of following up with communications, and we disgorged the contribution as appropriate. I think with bitcoins, it's going to have to be treated precisely the same way that it would be with prepaid credit cards or prepaid value cards from Visa or MasterCard, and that we will do everything we can that we already do and keep an eye out. But there's really, if somebody really wants to commit fraud, it's very hard for any PAC or any campaign to understand what they're doing unless they're hitting certain red flags. But we definitely look forward to that rulemaking.
And we will look forward to your comments on it. Let me ask a follow-up, because, I mean, on the one hand, we could effectively punt on this issue by saying, well, you've represented that you're going to provide the donor information. How you do it is up to you. If you don't manage to do it, then you can't really, any advisory opinion that we issued you that was premised on your commitment to do that wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on, and I know you understand that. So in one sense, I suppose we could. I think the approach that the all of the drafts currently take is basically we leave it on you. You know, you've said you're going to do this. We say fine, as long as you do it. Here's the rest of your answer. But I guess the question in my mind is following along the lines that Commissioner Ravel was on. Is there a heightened burden, in any sense, on you or on us to ensure that the public can get the disclosure that it's entitled to when we're dealing with a vehicle that is known for its ability to be used anonymously, and in fact, sometimes people seek it out exactly for that purpose as a way of conducting transactions without identifying actually who they are. Do we have some heightened responsibility given that we know that about Bitcoins?
I don't believe there's any, in a legal sense, no. I don't think there's any heightened responsibility, because if there were, it would apply to all forms of prepaid value cards, like prepaid credit cards. It would apply to other means of transmitting resources or financial value that where the donor can simply say, no, I'm going to give you this information. So I don't think there's a legal requirement to do so. Certainly, we're interested in what the commission develops in the rulemaking process to start addressing these problems. I realize this is a very large AOR in terms of questions, and our interest here is we know this is happening. We're getting requests to make this happen. We really want to understand, how do we do this right? How do we make sure that we're compliant? And you know, this is one of those issues that it's, you know, there's a burden on the committee. On our committee and on candidates who receive Bitcoins to fully comply with FEC regulations about best efforts in capturing donor data, our contributor data. And I think beyond that, there can't really. I would worry about a special set of rules for any particularized vehicle of transferring value that doesn't apply equally to other vehicles that can do the same thing. I mean, how do we apply something to Bitcoins that isn't also applied to prepaid credit cards or to prepaid cell phones? So I don't think there can be a heightened layer of effort, but to the extent that the commission issues a rulemaking on the overall medium of non-bank account held transactions, I think that might be something worth thinking about.
Other questions?
Yes. Mr. Backer, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I hear you've been under the weather.
A little bit.
I hope you're feeling better.
Thank you.
Sorry we're going to put you through this.
Well, it beats Liz.
He was putting us through it.
No, he's our customer. You've seen three drafts.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if we gave you a short notice on drafts B and C, but you know this is a exotic issue for us. Mm-hmm. You can see that we're struggling with the more academic question of what's money and then what's money under our regulatory regime versus what academically or theoretically may be money in an economic sense. But you've seen the three drafts. They're largely put out there for a gradation of discussion points. Mm-hmm. There is a fourth potential draft that could go farther, and some of the logic in draft C could go farther to say not only could a political committee re-gift an in-kind contribution of Bitcoins or anything else, but that in a political committee could also spend an in-kind contribution, and certainly in Barter Pack and the Silver Dollar advisory opinion, the commission has in the past allowed in-kinds to go out for the purchase of goods and services. So I guess I'm going to kind of throw you the bigger issue here. You've seen the gradations between drafts A, B, and C. Tell us which one you want and why. I mean, so tell us theoretically why we should land at B or C or A. So that that's sort of a big softball for you, because I want to give you the ability to come in and make your pitch.
My client prefers draft C of all the drafts, primarily because it recognizes that if Bitcoins are a thing of value and an individual may contribute it to a PAC or to a campaign, there doesn't seem to be a basis to prevent a PAC from making an in-kind contribution to a campaign using Bitcoins. That to us is probably the most relevant difference between drafts A, B, and C that we're particularly fond of. Beyond that, you know, the valuation issues and sort of the managerial and just practical issues involved in dealing with Bitcoins makes it a little harder to use them in certain contexts, and to arrive at this decision that, you know, whether or not they're money, that's a bigger question that I feel comfortable addressing, and I think the commission talks about that in these drafts. But the ability to spend Bitcoins, I think, is much more important to the to my client, and I think to similarly situated political organizations. They're going to want to be able to contribute in Bitcoin if that's how they want to contribute. And I think so that's one component. Another is, I think there's a desire to be able to spend Bitcoin for the purchase of goods and services, particularly because there are vendors who provide all purchasers using Bitcoin with a discount relative to cash. Why they choose to do that, I don't know, but I think from any organization is going to want to spend less value on a transaction than they have to, and because that discount is in the ordinary course of business applied to all like purchasers, regardless of the fact that they're political committees, we would hope that if maybe that's draft D, that the ability to disperse Bitcoins in those transactions be allowed. But we certainly recognize the logic of, hey, it's got to come from a campaign depository. So we understand the difficulty there. But I think the ability to make contributions in Bitcoin as an in-kind contribution that draft C envisions is the appropriate response.
Excuse me, may I continue?
Yes, Mr.
Mayor. There has been, you'll see knocking around in the various drafts, the commission searching for the right analogy. And one analogy that comes up is stock, securities. And there is a 2000 advisory opinion that said you cannot take in a in-kind contribution of stock and then re-gift it. Now, there was very little reasoning given for that. But can you address either a distinction between Bitcoins and stock, or B, why you think that advisory opinion was awry?
Well, I think there's a very large distinction between Bitcoins and stocks and bonds and other securities. Stocks are even an infinitesimal extent, a recognition of an ownership interest in another business. They're not just cash value in a form of paper. There's an ownership interest there. Bonds entitle the bearers to certain economic rights with the bond issuer, and both of these are very highly regulated to forms of activity. I don't think it's appropriate to treat Bitcoins in the same way. I think it would almost be like, I think Bitcoins may be best treated as, hey, buying and selling the future value of prepaid credit cards. They're not really stocks or bonds or other forms of equity or security interests. So I think there's an inherent problem in treating them in that same way. In terms of the re-gifting issue, you know, there's a technical problem there that we don't really have a good answer for, which is if I get a Bitcoin contribution today of one Bitcoin at $300 some odd, and I give it to a candidate in 2 weeks, and now it's $400, how do I properly account for that delta in value? I don't have a good answer for that. I don't think it's, you know, I don't know how we would do that. I think we'd want to know how to do that because we see a lot of value in doing so. You know, in terms of the receipt and then recontribution of those gifts, but I don't think it can be properly analogized to stocks or bonds or other highly regulated ownership interests.
May I continue? Well, on the delta value, I'd be interested in your reaction. If I take a contribution, a permissible in-kind contribution in, then on the day I take it in is valued at $300 on some market equivalent of its exchange value to U.S. dollars. which is what we work with here. We work with the U.S. dollar value of items. And then a month later, I want to make an in-kind contribution out of the same Bitcoin, but its equivalent value is now $400. Isn't that, well, I guess I'm asking, why isn't that as simple as reporting an in-kind in of 300 and an in-kind out of 400 on the day that it's given, all subject to limits and source prohibitions on the day that they're taken in and the day that they're passed along, just like, for example, a computer. You take a computer in on day one, perhaps valued at $1,000, and when you're ready to wind down, if you were to give an in-kind of that computer to someone else, it might be worth only $500. But the value in is $1,000, and the value out is $500. Would that not work? Maybe I'm missing the practical difficulty you're having.
I think there's a recognition in the depletion of value of material assets. I think with Bitcoins, and frankly, usually this occurs and I get something and now it's worth less when I dispose of it. I think when you're dealing with an increase of value, how do we practically account for that value in the FEC reporting platform? I use FecFile. It's a fantastic software, but it has a lot of limitations to it. And I don't know that we would that the technology right now is such that it would adequately convey into the public record this transaction. Now, maybe there's a workaround for that and using the existing technology, but I would be concerned that it would create problems because it doesn't make sense necessarily from the way the software currently operates.
But that's a software constraint?
Yeah, it's a practical, purely technical constraint of how do we properly report this?
How do you report the $100 increase in value in versus value out?
I think so, yes. And maybe it's time for some new line items to account for some of these unique and more exotic transactions that are starting to occur. I know we have this problem when we talk about contributions to IE-only accounts and non-contribution accounts, and I'll use the Commission's terminology rather than my own preferred terminology there. using line 17 to report income on to non-contribution accounts confuses other contributions that would otherwise be on line 17. And this is very technical, but it's a function of we're still using the same FEC file from 2009, more or less. So it's just a very practical, technical question to allow us to properly comply with the law and to make the entries into the public record that we're required to do.
Well let's discuss that. And Ms. Selenkoff, I may have a question for you about this. Let me start with this one, because the forms shouldn't drive the legal concept of what somebody's allowed to accept and pass out. In fact, if there are new technologies arising that stress our forms, and the internet has stressed so many regulatory regimes. Here you're just talking about a new form of exchange that's stressing our reporting regime. So if it's a matter of adapting forms to capture new ways of transacting, I'd be interested in that. How do we capture the increase in value today of a piece of stock that comes in, it appreciates in value, then you liquidate it? How do you reflect that increase in value?
I don't know the line numbers. I would have to check with Rad.
But there is a way to do that?
But we have ways of capturing both capital gains and losses on investments, as well as appreciation and depreciation of other assets held.
Can I prevail upon Ms. Ciccone?
Hi.
Same question.
Yes, sure. We actually worked up a reporting scenario for this situation, which wasn't attached to any blue document. But yeah, there is a workaround. Obviously, a line number would be a great solution, but we often have to find ways to disclose things that aren't specifically spelled out. And the way that your scenario would be reported is, you know, it would just be disclosed as an in-kind contribution coming in, as a normal in-kind on a receipt schedule and on a Schedule B going out. So there is no total coming in at all. So it doesn't affect the cash on hand total. And then when the amount appreciates later in a subsequent reporting period, that's how we worked it up, it would then again be disclosed on line 21B as that amount negated out with the in-kind being made on a different line number but Schedule B. So again, you're getting a zero effect on your cash on hand total, but all the disclosures there. Does that make sense?
Right, but I think the concern is I would be concerned about properly disclosing that increase in value, you know, the delta. There ought to be a line somewhere that says, I mean, I get that we can do it, but there ought to be a mechanism to do that, because I think people are going to be asking, wait, what happened? They had $1,000 in and they just put $5,000 out and it didn't affect their cash on hand. And so I worry about the public records.
Absolutely. Well, that's why we have indicated on the sample a proper description to tie the two together. So it would be clear on the public record what was going on, that the value was appreciated from a prior in-kind received.
Okay. Mr. Cohn, let me ask you another question, just looking forward. If there are going to be more exotic forms of currency that people want to move around, would it be practical to change the sort of fictitious construct we have today for in-kinds generally, of reporting an in-kind coming in on Schedule A, immediately listing a fictitious disbursement on Schedule B, and instead go to a separate schedule attached to reports for in-kinds, all in-kinds in and out? And from a layman's view outside, I would have said that would be more a more transparent way to track in-kinds in and out than to wash them through your cash through these constructs. Is that at least a conceivable or practical solution to this?
Agreed, yeah. I think the idea of a separate schedule or line number is great. We have ideas for that in other areas as well. But right now, the way that it's set up is just, in fact, to make the cash on hand right? So there's not really anything being dispersed and no money coming in. So to answer your question, yes, I think that would be okay. Definitely.
Thank you. So, Mr. Backer, if I understand, Mr. Cohn, the accounting issues can be worked out, and there are any number of ways to do it. There's the way that's currently done. There are other potential ways to do that. So assuming that that is resolved, can you speak to the legal issue of what you think the proper treatment is for a group taking in an in-kind contribution and then re-gifting it?
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, the drafts cite different advisory opinions as precedent on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask you, do you see a problem with allowing a committee to re-gift an in-kind contribution?
No, I don't. Both as a legal and a practical matter, I would say that the re-gifting of an in-kind contribution subject to the appropriate contribution limits on all ends is actually a very sensible and appropriate approach. I'll use a low-tech example. If a donor contributes a couple cases of paper to a political action committee, which would be not even close to the strangest thing that I've seen contributed to a political action committee, the PAC's not going to need the paper. Why not contribute it to a candidate? It has a, that's an easy one because there's a go to staples.com, there's the value. But the disposition of in-kind assets or in-kind contributions in their original form is a much more sensible approach than liquidation of that asset and then redistribution of it as cash. I think it makes a lot more sense, and it's a lot less burden on the PAC that's receiving this. By the way, one thing that it occurred to me while we were just talking, and I hadn't thought about this before, and perhaps this is a subject for a future conversation, but these drafts both treat the inflow and outflow of funds essentially the same between a non-contribution and a contribution account. But if the receipts are coming into a non-contribution account and it's not subject to any of these reporting limits, I'm wondering if there's perhaps other differences that might need to be explored in that area. And this just popped into my head. I'm still thinking about it out loud. But since you're not voting on it today, I thought I would at least put it out there that because the in-kind contributions do not create actual repairing the quid pro quo corruption and are subject to lesser levels of scrutiny and regulation than contributions to a contribution account, it would strike me that there probably are other differences in the way we treat in-kind contributions to and from those non-contribution accounts. By the way, the continued use of contribution in the names and the verbs and the nouns here is really why I think we should go with carry and non-carry accounts.
Well, you, of course, have a particular affection for that terminology, and we understand that, although a lot of people call them carry accounts. Haven't heard non-carry accounts as much, although, personally, I like super PACs because, everybody knows what they are, and it's easier to say than IEOPC. I hear what you're saying, Mr. Becker, about, you know, maybe there are some differences, but fundamentally, there's still the disclosure concern.
You know,
we still need to value, we still need to disclose. And that's what the reporting forms are all about, is making sure that that disclosure happens and happens effectively. Do any of my other colleagues have further questions, comments? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a question that is somewhat along the lines of what the Vice Chairman was talking about, and that is drawing the line. When does an in-kind have to be that is taken in by a committee have to be liquidated, and when does it not? We've been talking about, you know, computers or paper, office equipment. You can imagine all sorts of things that can be donated to a committee, and then we have stock, which. You know, according to at least the 2000 AOPAC.com, has to be liquidated. Like the vice chairman, I have some concerns about the reasoning in that, but it is what it is. And so, as I've been struggling with this issue about, okay, how do we draw the line of when does something that is in-kinded to a committee have to be liquidated, and when can it just be subsequently given as an in-kind contribution to a different committee? And one of the lines that was drawn is that, well, the less tangible the item becomes, once we go from something that's a computer, something you can look and touch and feel, to something that's a little more amorphous, like a stock, then maybe that's where you draw the line. But then I was also thinking, and I don't know if this has happened, but it could happen. What if you wanted to donate your frequent flyer miles to a campaign? It certainly is something that it has value, that can be readily assigned a monetary value, and it would be something that a campaign could use. But it is certainly much less tangible than a computer, a ream of paper, office equipment, and so forth. Would we be saying that, well, because it's less tangible, you would have to, if a campaign were to receive that that donation, they would then have to liquidate that, then take the money to then subsequently buy an airline ticket? Or could they just take those, and they're all, you know, very common mechanisms for transferring sky miles back and forth between accounts that then can be used for booking flights? So I think that several of us up here on the dais are struggling with where do we draw the line between when an in-kind contribution received has to be subsequently liquidated before it can then be, used by the committee, and when can they just take something that was brought in as an in-kind and then have it go out as an in-kind? And This may be more of a theoretical discussion that we have to talk about at the commission level, but just if you had any thoughts that might enlighten our minds on where we ought to consider drawing that line.
Mr. Becker.
Tough line to draw, but I think the frequent flyer mile example goes to the potential that I've heard might be part of Draft D, that of how do you spending these in-kind contributions, because frequent flyer miles, they do essentially have a value to the extent that you can transact them, that you can use them to buy different things. But you get them, they're there. Realistically, any value you get from transferring them out is substantially less than the value you would get from using them to buy a ticket. And because I can use the same number of frequent flyer miles to buy a $250 ticket as a $350 ticket, it's obviously in my interest to use those miles for the $350 ticket and use cash on the $250 ticket. And that's, I think, why part of this issue of, you know, we like to use bitcoins to buy stuff and services, because there are, in the ordinary course of business, big count purchase discounts. There are vendors, and probably going to be more and more vendors, that will only transact in Bitcoin for various reasons. And again, assuming the legality of the underlying transaction and that it's in accord with all the applicable contribution limits, I don't know that it's beneficial to impose unnecessary added costs on the political speech that is captured within monetary transactions. I'd rather have the ability to spend my $250 or $100 to buy the $250 ticket and another $100 to do any other act of speech rather than be forced to spend $350 on it. And again, if there's no special discount because it's a PAC or a campaign, it would seem that I'm from the school of thought that generally it's better to have more available capital to spend on political speech than not. Topic for another day, apparently, too, though.
Well, a follow-up to Commissioner Peterson's question. Mm-hmm. Hold aside purchasing goods and services. Simply in the re-gifting area, can you discuss, because I have concerns about the 2000 PAC.com advisory opinion and its conclusion, particularly in the area of re-gifting and in-kind. And so can you address that and whether there should be a certain line drawn at all on re-gifting in the air, depending on the tangibility or intangibility and liquidation of the in-kind? And I'm specifically on the ability to make a contribution to another political committee. But hold aside the issue of buying goods and services for just a minute.
I would be of the opinion that a thing is, if it's a thing of value, it's a thing of value. As long as you can adequately account for the delta in value between the receipt of it and its disbursement, that there's really no practical or legal reason to distinguish that contribution from, or to prohibit that contribution or create an additional burden on that contribution, as long as that intermediate value is accounted for. There doesn't seem to be a legal basis to do so unless there's some particular issue that I'm not aware of. So I would say that it ought to be permissible. It certainly would accord with the regulations, because if it's a thing of value coming in, it doesn't stop being a thing of value because we're holding on to it for however long length of time. And even if it's gained in value, the value, it's still that portion of it is still a thing of value as it goes out. So I'm of the opinion that it ought to be permissible, certainly as a campaign contribution. I also would argue that there's really no reason a political action committee couldn't buy bitcoins to contribute to a candidate for whatever reason, because that PAC promotes that issue. So I think the purchase of a thing of value with repository money is perfectly appropriate. And forcing the liquidation and then the repurchase of that creates an additional burden for really no particularly good reason. I don't think it fosters greater disclosure. I don't think it prevents any actual or apparent corruption that might have been there. There doesn't seem to be a rationale to do it, other than, yeah, maybe it's probably a little bit easier on the paperwork side, on the trends, but it's not easier on the burden to the reporting committee. And as the guy that ends up doing a lot of this stuff, it's really not easier at all. So I think that because it's a thing, if it's a thing of value, which seems to be the consensus, it's a thing of value in, it's a thing of value out. We just need to account for that delta. And there shouldn't be a separate legal regime imposed upon that.
Further questions or comments? Commissioner Walther.
Just to get a little education from you. How would you go about verifying the donor or the contributor? What information is made available when a transfer takes place? I'm just learning the mechanics here of how that works.
Well, mechanically, we would probably do it the same way we do PayPal transactions now or through other online vendors, where in order to make the contribution, the contributor is required to submit certain fields, first name, last name, address, city, state, zip, occupation, employer, and we also ask for phone and email for all of my clients just because you want that information. So we would require its submission. To the extent that we don't get it, we do the appropriate best efforts follow-up communication by phone, email, or mail. And so it would not be all that distinct. I reference PayPal because this is a constant problem with a lot of with candidates that I've worked with, where they're just getting started and they put in PayPal because everybody uses PayPal. But PayPal doesn't necessarily force capture the data that we would want as a camp for reporting purposes. So I normally my recommendation is if you want to use PayPal, you have to create an intermediate screen that captures all that information before forwarding you onto PayPal. Right. And I think that would be the likely technical way that I would encourage my clients to do this.
So if I understand it, I mean, this would be a mechanical thing that would be set up in this case for this purpose. But generally, how are bitcoins transferred between, forget the political situation here, but how are they normally transferred from one entity, A to B? And what information does B get when the transfer takes place?
I guess they can be transferred completely anonymously, though it would be sort of odd as to why they're being transferred anonymously. But, yeah, there is a potential to transfer them anonymously. The recipient may ask for some of that information. I think at a minimum you get the Bitcoin, the person who's giving you Bitcoins you'd have their username or their Bitcoin wallet URL address thing. Clearly I'm the technical expert here. And so there's limited information there. And I kind of, you know, if I'm right with where you're going with this, so A gives B some bitcoins, B doesn't know who A is, A may or may not be an appropriate contributor, B is not an appropriate contributor, B now has this bunch of bitcoins and they contribute it, so there's a concern that potentially it's a wash, but we're tracking the contribution to B as far as we can go. So I recognize that there's a problem there, but I don't think it's any different than my giving somebody cash, my giving somebody a prepaid phone card, prepaid credit card, or a prepaid cell phone to make those contributions.
So you can, if you're buying a Bitcoin, because I'm just trying to learn how Bitcoin gets transferred, the transferor doesn't, outside our regime, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have to get specific identifying information in theory. And so I understand a Bitcoin has a computer ID somewhere,
mm-hmm. yes,
in the wherever that is. But that's the thing that gets transferred, if I'm not mistaken. It would be just
that's accurate
in identifying one of the $21 million bits.
Yeah. As a practical matter, it's a very long string of ones and zeros gets transferred from one computer wallet to another, and so the only identifying information one might have is the identity of that account. So it would be, you know, DBCA 1385 or something. It might be all that I would get as a recipient outside of whatever reporting regime is imposed.
Well, I raise a question because it may come a time where our audit group needs to audit something, and how could they go about auditing a Bitcoin receipt or a transfer or anything like that? Is it totally up for grabs? I mean, it seems like the credit card, you've got a credit card, you've got an actual, at the origin of the credit card, there was some real information out there, and you can trace back to find out if the user was the actual owner of the credit card. With the Bitcoin, how do we do that in audit?
Well, I don't know that's necessarily the case anymore because of the ability to buy prepaid stores of value with cash. I could go to CVS, buy with a couple $100 bills and not provide any information and get these cards, activate them, and then use them to engage in this sort of commerce. So there's no real differentiation between Bitcoin and that activity, which is currently permissible or certainly possible. In terms of the audit trail, the audit division would have the information that we captured from the contributor. Let's hypothetically assume that it's all fake information. So then all you'd have is that money came from Bitcoin wallet X to our Bitcoin wallet. There's the ability to track who's the owner of Bitcoin wallet X. Now you're dealing with maybe it's somebody who's doing this in a jurisdiction that doesn't recognize federal election codes, for example, the Netherlands. And so I can see that there may be that problem in capturing those transactions and sort of being able to audit back to the ultimate donor. I just don't think it presents any greater potential for fraud, misconduct, misuse, or abuse than current mechanisms. And I think because of the sophistication involved in this and, who knows how much depth is in that computer data that's there, there's probably better ways to track it down than, folks showing up with anonymous bags of cash at campaigns.
One more time. I hear you on that, but what about the situation of our need to be able to decipher what kind of money, whether it's foreign money or not? Does that make a difference? Is Bitcoin so amorphous out there that there's no way that we could take a look at that issue?
I don't think there's any greater ability to do that than there is with prepaid credit cards or prepaid cell phones. I'm not aware of a mechanism that would allow us to differentiate between the receipt of those two forms of money. So either could be purchased theoretically with foreign money. I think, I understand that if you started getting a lot of Bitcoin contributions or prepaid credit contributions, and I would be a little surprised with that. I'd be like, all of a sudden we're getting a lot of money. In fact, I've had a client who one day got something like $10,000 in $35 and $50 contributions through an online platform, and we immediately were like, well, this doesn't look right. And then we looked into it, and it was all fraudulent transactions, and there was a long and unpleasant experience of refunding and getting that out of our accounts and dealing with that vendor. But other than the natural red flags that might be seen by a sudden timely influx of these transactions, there's really no different way for us to approach them than prepaid credit cards, prepaid cell phones, or anonymous envelopes of cash, at $49 a pop showing up at the headquarters. It's not a very a good answer, I'm sure, but it's sort of what we're stuck with.
Learning process.
Let me follow up on that a little bit. And again, we're all, I think, grappling with. I doubt if any member of the commission has ever engaged in a Bitcoin transaction. So we're trying to.
If it makes you feel better, neither have I.
Well, maybe we're all learning together. I was going to say if there's someone else that you're working with that's more knowledgeable that you want to bring to the table with you next time, that would be fine. But I guess you represent the political committee, not the. You're not with BitPay or Bit
no.
or any of these Bit foundations, which of course suggests that perhaps we might get better information in the rulemaking context where we could draw witnesses from different sectors. But when we consider the text messaging AOs, for example, some of us were concerned about the potential for foreign money coming in through text messaging, and the requesters were able to assure us that they could guarantee that wouldn't happen, that foreign-bought phones wouldn't be used as a vehicle and that contributions wouldn't be accepted from them. Are you aware of any way that any kind of precautions could be put into place to block Bitcoin transactions from a foreign, or at least raise a flag on it?
Theoretically, we could require that we could only accept contributions from Bit vendor or Bit wallets that have some sort of national identification tag on it, being either in the U.S. or, you know, well, I'd be hesitant about limiting the receipt of Bitcoins only to U.S. accounts, largely for the same reasons that I commented on the text messaging, you know, is there's a lot of Americans who live overseas who don't buy American cell phones to communicate abroad, and I thought particularly deployed military. And so that to me presented a problem. But we could theoretically try to implement that. I don't know that it's technically possible, but there may be a way to make it work. Certainly if that became an industry standard, that would prevent us from we may require it, and if you don't have a compliant BitPay account, we can't take your contribution. BitPayment account. I don't want to single that company out for anything here. There may be a technical wraparound, but I don't think that solves the problem at all, because I can have a BitPay account here in the United States and just, you know, use foreign money to load that account, much the way I could come from the Netherlands, and I don't know why I'm picking on them today, but I am, with a couple hundred thousand kroner, buy a bunch of prepaid, converted at the airport, buy a bunch of prepaid cards, and start using those. So identifying the sources of national origin is a lot trickier than it seems, particularly if somebody is in the business of engaging in fraud. And ultimately, what we're talking about is the ability of individuals who are willfully and knowingly violating a U.S. election law in order to commit a criminal act. So I don't really see a...
Not necessarily. Not necessarily, because it could be someone who doesn't understand. They might be somebody who's, you know, either has spent time in the United States or not, but for whatever reason, they're not aware that they're not allowed to contribute as a foreign national. So it's not necessarily a knowing and willful violation of law. It's not necessarily a fraud. There could be a fraud. And I agree with you that if someone is determined to commit fraud, it's very hard to put in enough rules that could stop that. There's always a way for somebody to commit fraud, but there are in other contribution contexts certain red flags that would put a committee on alert that this contribution came in from a foreign country doesn't necessarily mean it's illegal. It could be a U.S. citizen who's living abroad. It could be, as you say, military or State Department or just, you know, an expat. But it is a red flag that committees with careful vetting procedures would look into and at least inquire. And so what I'm trying to figure out is there a way to at least raise that red flag so that committees would know to inquire further? And I just don't know enough about Bitcoin transactions to know whether that's possible or not.
I would say as a technical matter, it probably is possible as a technical matter, but as a legal matter, I don't know that it's something that could be imposed. And I think you know, the problem that I would see is you've got a lot of different Bitcoin vendors, and they've all are bit payment processors. They've all developed and substantially developed their codes and their mechanisms, and now we're saying, hey, if you want your accounts to be able to be used in this way, you need to do this other thing. And even in doing that thing, I'm not so sure that it would necessarily help us get at the problem that we're getting at. You know, you reference people who just don't know better making contributions. Every one of my clients has the affirmations and disclaimers on the bottom of the donation page is precisely for that. I'm a U.S. citizen or I'm a permanent resident with a green card. So I think, and yeah, if somebody's planning to commit fraud, they're just going to check the box anyway. But if somebody's from a foreign country, we do see that when checks come in or when transactions come in, and that is something that most of my clients do follow up on, particularly if it's, you know, anything above a $30 contribution.
And that's my point, just that I'm exploring whether there are available mechanisms for people to know to ask more questions when they receive these contributions.
Well, if I may, one thing that might really help is, you know, there is the regulations. And there are there's sort of the way that these things are done, but there's a lot of best practices that we communicate to our client. And probably if the FEC were to issue something along the lines of, hey, these are some good best practices we would suggest you employ, I think that would be well received by the political user community, particularly if it helped us in a situation where there was a problem, there was a fraud, and we say, look, we did what you suggested we do in terms of employing our best practices. So at a minimum, even though this transaction was a bad transaction, we certainly aren't on the hook for any sort of additional penalty or burden because we did the things that you suggested were the right way to go.
And as you know, we've done that before. We issued best practices as a safe harbor against embezzlement, any liability that might be associated with reporting violations on embezzlement. So we've gone down that road before. I'm not sure that right now we know enough about Bitcoin transactions to be able to issue knowledgeably best practices. You may or may not know the answer to this either, but again, I'm trying to get my arms around exactly how this works. So does the recipient of a Bitcoin transaction have to take some affirmative step to accept it, or can it land in their – can someone just transfer something into your account without your affirmative acceptance. Okay, I'll take the vice chairman's suggestion.
I would, as my understanding that, yeah, you can transfer money to me. The money will land in my BitWallet. I'll get a notification that this has occurred, so I'm aware of the transaction, but I don't have to accept your contribution. Now, that may not be the case for all vendors, but some vendors do allow that to occur.
And how would you go about not accepting?
I have no idea. I think basically it would actually be more like a refund or a denial. Like, you know, I get a notice like, oh, I don't know what this transaction is, revert. And
that was my next question is, if you don't have, you know, let's say you get a contribution, you don't know who it's from, there's no identifying information, mm-hmm. so you want to return it without that identifying information, does the marketplace allow for you to return it to that other anonymous Bitcoin wallet?
Well, it might, but in that circumstance, I would actually liquidate and disgorge it in accordance with existing FEC regulations and, you know, give it to a charity rather than try to go through the process of whatever hunting that person down is. And ultimately, the existing rules on disgorging transactions really does provide a good recourse here. If there are suspicious transactions and we don't know where they're coming from, disgorge and can donate.
Vice Chairman.
Following up on that, is it possible to put a screen on your wallet so that people don't automatically have access to your wallet to put Bitcoins into your wallet?
I don't know. I would assume as a technical matter, it's certainly possible to do through one or more vendors. I don't know that all of them have that capability, but I think theoretically it's certainly possible to have a net there. But realize that, you know, whether it goes into the net or goes into the wallet, it's still ones and zeros. So even if it's in the wallet and I get the notice, I can kick it back out or disgorge. So I don't know that there's a lot of added value to create that screen as opposed to just the notice on the inbound recipient side. And it's fun with all this technology because we keep thinking about these as sort of physical objects, but really it's just ones and zeros zipping back and forth between servers.
Right. On the issue that Commissioner Walther raised of audit trail, I mean, you acknowledge, we all acknowledge, I think, that it would be unlawful for somebody to give you a false name and attribute their contribution to somebody who didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then so at the end of every audit trail, regardless of whether you're able to get the check or trace it through a credit card, at the end of every audit trail, there should be a person, right?
Hopefully, yes. Or if it's a non-contribution account, a corporate entity.
Okay. And so
at labor organization?
At the end of the day, if you report that John Smith provided you $1,000 in bitcoins, if someone wants to check the validity of that representation or that report, they can find John Smith and ask John Smith, right? I mean, that's the way a lot of name of another cases are found, right?
I would assume, and to the extent that the data is report, we're capturing that $1,000 contribution and that contributor's information, assuming they gave it to us in the first place or we're getting it in the best efforts part. There's a way to track that down at some level. And in the audit process, if it's determined, hey, there's no John Smith, then that's a separate issue.
Or there is a John Smith, and John Smith says, I never donated any bitcoins.
And I think we just had the somewhat highly publicized case of Seymour Bacon, who contributed to Mitt Romney's campaign, and then everyone's like, oh, well, that's obviously a fake name, but in fact, there was a real guy. So, and not an Onion article, so.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, I think there's a general interest up here. There's a balancing act here. That there's this new technology that no one wants to strangle in its infancy. It may become, maybe a flash in the pan. It may become something that becomes an everyday component of our lives. That 30 years from now, we were wondering, wow, how did we ever live in this world without them? So we don't want to be responsible for having squelched this. But there's also the concern that we have about.
I don't think we're that powerful.
Well, no, having been a party to it, I know that there are many other agencies that are doing the same thing. So, while at the same time trying to make sure that there are adequate protections so that it couldn't serve as a vehicle for illegal or prohibited contributions to flood into the system. One thing I noticed in some comments that were filed by Perkins Coie on behalf of the Bitcoin Foundation, I'm looking at page 5, it talks about how it says the public details of transactions can be viewed by any Bitcoin user or anyone else running the Bitcoin open source software. Although Bitcoin transactions are private in the sense that there are no names attached to the public keys recorded in the blockchain, all transactions associated with any given public key may be easily viewed and analyzed. And then it says, this provides an unprecedented level of transparency to financial transactions. As we discussed below, this transparency is one of the features of the Bitcoin network that makes it ideally suited for political contributions. And as you'd mentioned, you're representing a client, you're not representing a Bitcoin Foundation. So while I'm on live mic, this might be just my invitation to the extent that you could add any more detail to that, that'd be fine. If not, since we are going to be holding this for another week, to the extent that those who are much more knowledgeable about this technology than we are could provide any sort of comment or detail indicating how that, as they call it, unprecedented transparency could actually be marshaled to ensure that there aren't illegal contributions, foreign contributions, excessive contributions, et cetera, flooding into our system. I think that would be very welcome. I know for me, and I think for everybody up here.
I concur with that, Commissioner Peterson. Anybody out there probably everybody, the field of people out there who are more knowledgeable about how bitcoins work than we are is probably vast. So if any of those folks want to comment, we would welcome that. It's interesting because I did focus on that same phrase in the comment, but then I noticed that it goes on to say on the next page, and also Bitcoin is highly protective of individual freedom. While the public details of every transaction are included in the blockchain, Bitcoin users can choose whether to reveal their identity when engaging in transactions. It's incredibly transparent, except that the identity of the individuals may be completely obscured. So that's, and that, of course, is exactly the trend, knowing how many ones and zeros are in the chain isn't really helpful to us or to the public. It's the identity of the individual behind it that is the key fact, and I think that animates some of commissioners' concerns about whether this could be a particularly potent vehicle for people to hide their identities. And, I see you are.
I think you hit the nail on the head that there's transactional transparency on how these ones and zeros move around and which specific ones and zeros versus the origination transparency, which is who the contributor is.
That's what we really want to know.
Yeah. That's a whole separate conversation for contributions that are above that need to be reported for the source of origination. I think that there's technical issues there, and all we can do is what we do already for similar situated forms of transferring stored values of wealth.
Commissioner Walther?
Just to learn a little more, the Bitcoin, emanate really out of basically one computer. I understand there's 21 million potential ones. They're not all issued, if that's what you call it, but they're in play. But that it's one creation, and from there it has an identifying, I can't remember, 38 numbers or some large number of numbers, and that particular mental thing transfers, emanates from that, and that number stays intact with that Bitcoin all the way through. Is it like a dollar? Is like the serial number on a dollar or something like that?
I think a serial number on a dollar is probably a really good way of thinking about it in terms of the identifying that particular unit, though not the actual value. Right. As I understand it, that's about right. That one guy came up with it and created this technology, and it's out there. Right. But it isn't just Bitcoins. There's Litecoins is another variation of this. There's going to be others. My sense is that the ability to engage in these private economic transactions is it's desirable to people, and they're going to keep doing it. A couple years ago, there was a craze when these massive multiplayer online games, you could use real money to buy money inside the game and buy stuff, and that you could then sell your stuff or your money inside the game to people for real money. And so I think this idea that there is such a thing as stored values there's a stored value denominated in U.S. dollars. They're captured in whether it's some string of ones and zeros, whether it's a Bitcoin, a Litecoin, a World of Warcraft, whatever it was, or a prepaid credit card. And those values, the ability to engage in that transactional activity once you've originated it, I think creates a lot of opportunity. So there's going to be a lot more things like Bitcoin. It's really one particular part of a whole category that's emerging. And so I think maybe a rulemaking is ultimately a better vehicle to address a lot of these concerns. I think some of the initial ones are perhaps easier, maybe along the lines of Draft C.
Good response.
World of Warcraft comes to the FEC. Words I never thought I'd hear at this table. If my colleagues have no further questions, we appreciate your time and your energy, Mr. Backer, and Ms. Zelenkoff. We appreciate all of your work as well. We will hold this matter over for commissioners to contemplate more about Bitcoin transactions, and we will, in any event, see you at our next meeting, so I know we're not taking you out of your way to invite you back again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Backer. So we will hold that matter over and move on to the next item on our agenda, proposed final audit report on the Arizona Republican Party. Gentlemen, who would like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Agenda items 1343 and 1343A are the proposed final audit report on the Arizona Republican Party and an edited version containing non-substantive changes to clarify the Commissioner's intentions regarding the adoption of the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum and to remove unnecessary language from the original proposed final audit report. We are available to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I love removing unnecessary language. Are there any questions for either the auditors or counsel or comments by my colleagues? If not, we can entertain a motion. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document number 13-43-A, the proposed final audit report on the Arizona Republican Party, which is number A11-21.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson has moved approval of the proposed final audit report on Arizona Republican Party, A11-21, as set forth in agenda document 13-43A. Are there any comments on the motion? It's my understanding that a couple of my colleagues who were not here for the long and exciting audit are going to abstain on this. So we won't have six votes at the end, but that's perfectly appropriate. So I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 4-0 with 2 abstentions. The 4 being, I should specify, Commissioner Walther, Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, and myself, and the 2 abstentions are the Vice Chairman and Commissioner Ravel. Thank you. Sorry to make all of you gentlemen come up here for that, but we appreciate all the work that went into it. And the next item on the agenda is the final determination on entitlement to primary election public funds for Governor Gary Johnson, Gary Johnson 2012, Inc., LRA 905. And nobody moved. Oh, no, somebody moved. We have one new face. Okay. So who will be presenting on this? Mr. Bloom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Agenda document number 1344 is a draft final determination on entitlement to primary election public funds for Governor Gary Johnson and his principal campaign committee, Gary Johnson 2012, Inc. Governor Johnson was the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate during the 2012 election cycle, and he has been receiving matching payments for the primary election in accordance with the Presidential Primary Matching Payment Account Act and the Commission's regulations implementing that law. The Commission made an initial determination to suspend the payment of matching funds to Governor Johnson on April 24, 2013. As a result of a mandatory audit of Governor Johnson's campaign committee, the Commission concluded that the candidate and the candidate's committee no longer had net outstanding campaign obligations. Under the procedure set forth in 11 CFR section 9034.5G, the committee submitted written materials contesting the initial determination. We have reviewed these materials and have concluded that Governor Johnson is in fact no longer entitled to receive matching funds because the committee no longer has net outstanding campaign obligations. Accordingly, we have submitted the current document with a recommendation to make the suspension of payments of matching funds final. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Do we have any questions for either counsel or the auditors or any discussion on this matter? Or a motion? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yes, Madam Chair. With respect to the final determination on entitlement to primary election public funds for Governor Gary Johnson and Gary Johnson 2012, Inc., I move that the Commission approve the recommendations set forth in agenda document number 13-44, making a final determination that Governor Johnson is not entitled to receive any further payments of matching funds pursuant to 11 CFR section 9034.5 subparagraph G, approve the attached statement of reasons, and approve the appropriate letters.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. You make very thorough motions. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the recommendations in the final determination on entitlement to primary election public funds for Governor Gary Johnson and Gary Johnson 2012, Inc., as set forth in agenda document number 13-44. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters that we need to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned. Everybody have a nice lunch.